keeping intelligence secret, harms huge numbers of people. Take the weapons of mass destruction intelligence. If someone had leaked that before the invasion, it was a very good chance the invasion wouldn't have happened, and all the turmoil that came with it in the Middle East would not have happened. Behind a wall of secrecy, bad decisions are often made because they're not contestable. No one's looking over the shoulder and saying, what's that?
Hi, you're with Bill Birnbauer, the CEO of Democracy's Watchdogs, and that was Brian Toohey. I first noticed Brian's stories around 1980, when he was the Washington correspondent for the Australian Financial Review and the National Times. He had an endless supply of leaks about Australia's intelligence services and national security blunders. After he left Washington, he reported and edited on the National Times and continued to get leaks that were highly embarrassing to the federal government. The stories Brian Toohey broke were stories that governments did not want to see the light of day. He exposed that radioactive contamination still existed at Maralinga, which had been the site of British atomic tests in the 1950s and the 1960s. He showed that it was actually the CIA and not Australia that ran the Pine Gap surveillance base. His reporting was a constant thorn in the side of federal governments, so much so that it led to one Prime Minister wanting to tap his work phone, ASIO bugging his home, being dragged to court in various bids to block his stories, and being hauled before the Senate Privileges Committee. Brian Toohey no longer works in mainstream media, but he continues to publish articles and books about national security and government secrecy. There's no other journalist who has written as much about the secrets of our intelligence agencies, or indeed rankled government ministers and senior bureaucrats with his high-level leaks.
We should all remember the weapons of mass destruction. That was absolutely phony, that intelligence. It was concocted to shape policies. And I don't think journalists now are sceptical enough of what the intelligence agencies are telling them, especially as I think the intelligence agencies are much more into sort of pushing propaganda or pushing a line than probably was the case back in the 70s and 80s.
What do you think made the 80s or the 70s? Was it the post-Watergate era?
I think the American example was a contributing part. I mean, I came back from Washington to work for the National Times, and I was pretty struck by then the legacy of those congressional inquiries into the CIA and that. There was journalists digging around and what the intelligence agencies were up to, whereas now it's the opposite. Journalists just go to the intelligence agencies and basically get given a story and print it without questioning any of it. Same happens in America now. There's a very big change in that regard.
What's happened?
I think it's easier to get a story out of the intelligence services than have to run around and find one of your own. That's one thing. And I think partly a lot of journalists have taken an ideological stand, if you want to call it that, very, very critical of China, not of other countries, and that's been pushed by the intelligence services.
Do you think journalists have the right contacts in the intelligence services to report what's actually happening?
I don't think they're reporting critically what the intelligence services are doing. They're taking it as true. And I don't think journalists now are sceptical enough of what the intelligence agencies are telling them, especially as I think the intelligence agencies are much more into sort of pushing propaganda or pushing a line than probably was the case back in the 70s and 80s.
Let's be clear, when you're talking about intelligence agencies, which organisations are you referring to?
Well, ASIO is one of the ones that's involved in this. I think to some extent the Australian Signals Director, and I think the Department of Home Affairs, or more to the point, its head, Michael Pezzullo, is involved deeply in this sort of stuff.
So they fly the flag of national security in order to limit some discussion.
I think that's definitely the case. I mean, at the same time as we've had this big campaign from the media about the importance of the freedom of press, the right to know, freedom of expression, etc., what some of the journalists are doing or have been doing really flies in the face of that. They're at times favouring crushing down on freedom of expression. I'll give you one example. It's on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald. A journalist reported there, using an unnamed source, that Paul Keating would have to register as an agent of foreign influence. And the report was it was very in favour of that happening. It wasn't just a neutral report. And the basis of this was that Keating, as publicly known, was on the board along with the Chinese infrastructure, or development bank, I should say, Chinese development bank. What the report didn't say is so were a lot of other retired central bankers, Henry Kissinger, et cetera, at different times. And he was paid nothing. They were paid $3,000 a year or something. So the second step as to why Keating was an agent of foreign influence was that the proof given by the journalist was he'd recently given a speech favouring a more independent foreign policy, as millions of Australians do, and of course Keating did when he was Prime Minister. Now, how on earth, that is basically taking the side of those who want to crush free speech, and Keating certainly took it that way.
This still makes you angry.
Well, I just think it's bad journalism, and it's also shaping, which is quite dangerous in the end, a sort of poisonous approach towards China. China's there, whether we like it or not.
So context's important.
Yes, definitely is.
And some of these stories simply don't seem to have it, right?
No, they don't. They take a sort of... there's just always the same line. It's very noticeable on the ABC.
When you were editing the National Times, it was incredible in a number of stories that broke. Organised crime and political corruption and so forth.
And some of the security
There's never
stuff.
Been anything like it.
Well,
since,
I'm not sure. I mean, other people were doing this at the time, and a lot of journalists were doing it. We got a lucky break, I suppose, on some things. In the case of the quite distinct difference between how Malcolm Fraser, he was not very aggressive about taking newspapers to court or journalists to court, whereas the Hawke government was. I'll just give you a contrast. As I got hold of the top secret Hope Royal Commission report on the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, and Fraser did not make any attempt to take Fairfax, where I was writing, to court. What he did do was ask the head of ASIO at the time, Harvey Barnett, to tap my phone in the Parliament House in Canberra. And Harvey Barnett said no. I'm not going to do that. Parliament House is the pinnacle of the Australian parliamentary system. Intelligence agencies should not be tapping phones in there. That was a big change since then.
Why has it changed that dramatically?
I think that the intelligence agencies now are they're much more players in the game. In the past, it used to be the Foreign Affairs Department was at the pinnacle of international relations, that the Prime Minister's Department was important, Defence Department, which I think it shades over now into the Security Services, but the Security Services, or Intelligence Services, were very much bit players back then, and now they're the dominant players, which is an unhealthy thing.
You got some great leaks in your career, particularly I'm referring on this time to the Frank Costigan reference was passed on to the National Crime Authority, newly formed. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, we published something like 36. These were called summaries because the Costigan Commission was being wound up, partly because Bob didn't like what it was doing in relation to Packer. But Kerry Packer, that is. We published all of these summaries, cut down versions of them over 2 weeks, but the only thing that caused any interest was the Packer thing. And oddly enough, the name of the thing was, of the Packer thing, they had code names on them. That was the squirrel or the squirrel analysis or something. And I thought, well, hang on, he has said during a public hearing that he, to explain how I had a lot of cash, that he had a squirrel mentality, he'd like to stack the cash away or whatever. And so I changed it. Well, not I didn't. It was the deputy editor, Adele Horan, who came up with the name the Guana. But Packer, I thought, tactically, took a very good decision. That was to go public and claim that it was him.
I am Goanna.
That's right.
That story was quite explosive. What was what was the aftermath of it?
Well,
you were accusing the Goanna of organised crime, drug trafficking and nefarious activities.
I don't think I was. I was reporting faithfully. It was all word for word from the Costigan summaries. Was the main thing that I think was had some substance to it all was tax avoidance, tax evasion. I think that was pretty substantive. No serious person, even though Packer might have had a lot of chutzpah, he didn't actually get boxes of drugs addressed to his office, you know. Yeah. And that was what they were after, was some painters and doctors who were apparently supposed to be involved in it. Their criticism was that the police hadn't taken any investigation into it. And there's a couple of other things.
And Fairfax editors supported you?
Well, the editors did. I don't know that the management was all that happy about that, because it was, the sort of rivalry between the two firms was pretty intense, but I don't think they wanted to see this sort of... I just don't really know whether... Mm-hmm. I mean, it got published, and... Yeah.
The National Times was changed sometime later because it wasn't making money, I think. Does that suggest something about how difficult it is to publish investigative stories?
I don't think that was a factor at all. It was losing a very, very small amount of money, and some of it was because it was spread across different parts of, say, the carpool and that, which we hardly ever used, or share of the London office, which we didn't have anyone there. It was a national paper, and it's notoriously difficult to get ads for national papers. I mean, as far as I know, The Australian doesn't make a profit after all these years. So it was changed, which I thought was a good idea, from a tabloid across to the broadsheet format, but then they ended up losing significantly more money, and it was closed down then.
What was the Maralinga story?
There were two stories there that caused trouble. One was I wrote for the Financial Review when I was in Canberra, and that was a cabinet submission. I got hold of a cabinet submission by the then Defence Minister, Jim Killen, which said there is a discrete lump of plutonium buried at Maralinga, and it could be a potential... It was written by him with too much colour about how much a group of more energetic and dedicated men could go there and dig it up and take it away. And you could make a dirty bomb out of it. You couldn't make a full fission explosion.
What did those stories reveal, though? What had happened at Maralinga, for people who don't know?
Oh, well, before that, it was in the British in the 1950s and the 60s. Did two separate tests there. What they call the major tests were exploding nuclear bombs and in the atmosphere. So a whole lot of dust took, there were dust storms and clouds taking it all across Australia, lots of parts of Australia, and that the fallout definitely ended up killing people. You can't identify individual people, but that's definitely would have been the outcome of that. But just as dangerously, they did what they called minor tests, and this was held in unbelievable secrecy down there, where they were blowing up discs of plutonium. And part of the trials were to build triggers. They were developing developing hydrogen bombs, and they needed a fission bomb as the trigger to to fuse the isotopes of hydrogen that are used in the H-bomb. And And that was all kept unbelievably secret. And worse, the head of the Australian Safety Committee was a guy called Ernest Titterton, who was the professor of physics at the ANU, but had worked on the, and was stayed, remained a British citizen, and had worked on the British thing. And in the report, a Royal Commission report that Jim McClellan headed, said that he was an agent of the British, who considered himself to be an agent of the British. He was, without doubt, the worst foreign agent ever, the most damage done by any foreign agent in Australia. If ASIO had been doing its job, it would have nabbed him and had him. but that was the problem with it. And the journalism at the day, they just did make no effort to find out what was happening.
Where were these explosions?
Well, three were off Montebello Islands, off the Western Australian coast. Most were down at Maralinga in South Australia, and then further up in South Australia, a place called Emu. And there were three there. And
you got no doubt that a local Indigenous community would have been exposed to radioactive.
Well, though certainly that was not a good job done of trying to keep them out. And they were, a lot of them wandered around. Some were found sitting on the edge of the crater of one test and that. And there was just a careless attitude at that stage to those in charge of the fate of the Aboriginals there. The whole thing changed a lot then with this thing I wrote in the National Times. I got hold of a top secret British report about what cleanup effort they'd done. And the government back in 68 had then indemnified Britain of any more damages or whatever. The cleanup effort was appalling. Given all the dust and the dust storms out there, they were using graders, which sort of took the topsoil up, blowing sand everywhere, et cetera, et cetera. And all their figures were wildly wrong about what sort of radioactivity was and what the amount of plutonium was. And that article in the National Times prompted, this was the Hawke government, which often was taking me to court, but not this occasion because it was not their fault. And they were happy to get some good, keen scientists who went around and did new studies there. And it was an appalling amount of plutonium left there. And a much better clean up effort was undertaken. But there's no way of guaranteeing that there isn't more there in the dust and circulating around with winds and so forth.
Even today?
Even today, yeah.
It's quite scandalous.
It is. It's enormously scandalous. And it was all done in secret. The Menzies did not want to know what it was about. And he was taking all of his advice from the British, basically. And
at the time you wrote those stories, Jim Killen, the Defence Minister, was somewhat upset.
Jim was an extreme... A lot of journalists, liked him as a bon vivant and, witty and all this sort of stuff. But there was something absolutely wrong with him. And his cabinet colleagues knew that he had put this submission in, and he knew that they knew what I'd written was accurate. And he was going around denying it and so forth and so on. He lost that part of the portfolio.
He said at one stage you couldn't write about a minute.
Sense of humour in that sense. What he said was that I couldn't report a minute's silence accurately, but I could report his cabinet submission accurately.
You also reported the truth about Pine Gap.
Yes, that was one of the things where the best and the brightest in the country let us down. What Pine Gap does, and has done from the start, is it contributes. It's linked to a satellite. It's always looking down at the same spot, so that's a geostationary or geosynchronous satellite. And what it does is it contributes to the American mass surveillance system, and it also contributes directly to the warfighting machinery because it gives targeting information, that sort of thing. And that was true from the start, and instead... both the officials, and unfortunately it was a friend of mine, Des Ball, an ANU specialist on this, they took secret briefings from the Americans that said, look here, one of the things we want to push with you is that it's all benign because it's about monitoring arms control or verifying arms control treaties. Well, it wasn't. That was done by a different sort of satellite, the photographic surveillance satellites, because what you had to do, the treaties required you to count the number of missiles and the number of warheads. Mm-hmm. Now, all Pine Gap could do was get some data about a missile test, one missile test. And then after I wrote that it was in fact a CIA-run base, Whitlam, it took an awful lot of effort, but dragged out of Tang that in fact it was a CIA-run base. You know.
Tang being the head of the...
Defence Department, I should have made that clear.
Yeah. Head of the Defence Department. So Tang lied to Whitlam, but basically the Australian people were lied to as well about...
He wanted him basically to lie to Parliament because, in other words, he was urging Whitlam to not tell the truth to Parliament. Mm.
And you were described as the greatest threat to national security ever.
Who, by the Tang,
by
I think.
Tang.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you wear that? How did you wear that?
Oh, as a badge of honour. But the thing was, he was. Subsequently intensely embarrassed by the fact that while he was trying to keep the knowledge of what Pine Gap did and who ran it and all of that to an incredibly small number of very, very senior people in defence and the defence intelligence agencies.
There's been a spate of national security laws in Australia, many of which have limited the right of journalists to do their jobs.
That's not the only thing. They were going to put a lot of people in jail. They shouldn't have been there.
Criminalised journalists.
Including, and whistleblowers.
And whistleblowers, that's right. Is this just a small part of a broader picture?
There's an extraordinary explosion in national security laws. I mean, there are no terrorism laws in Australia until after the 2001, in the hijacking of the planes and the blowing up of the buildings in New York. Now there are something like 82 terrorism laws, plus a whole lot of redone espionage laws and so forth, which have draconian sentences, but equally a whole lot of new laws which make it very, very hard for, say, whistleblowers to get in touch with journalists.
Australia seems to be leading the pack in terms of restrictive national security laws. How did that happen?
Well, that's an example. And another one at the moment is what they call the anti-encryption law. Of course, the governments love us encrypting everything, but they don't want others to do it because it makes it hard for police and them to tell what someone's saying over the phone or in telexes or what they're saying in internet messages and so forth. So they are forcing, there's two components to it, the law, but they're forcing the tech companies to build weaknesses into their computer systems to let them get the raw message before it's encrypted, right? And that, as far as I know, has not happened anywhere else in the world. We can do it because we don't have any laws protecting free speech or protecting the press, etc., and which they do in Europe and they do in the United States, and that doesn't happen here in Australia. And if you really want to do something, you start bringing in a Bill of Rights or whatever in Australia that would cover these things.
I can't see a push for that.
I can't see a push at all. I mean, some of these laws are outrageous.
What's that doing to our democracy?
Well, I think it's undermining our democracy badly. And as I say, I do think that for quite a while, many of the journalists who are reporting on intelligence things were basically on side with these laws rather than opposing them.
Why would they act like that?
I think it got them a story, a very easy way to get a story. Didn't put them at any risk, didn't put the paper at any sort of legal risk.
So do you think the national security laws are basically all about secrecy and avoiding embarrassment, or do you think they do have some impact in terms of terrorism and so forth?
I think you'd have to say that they've been of some use in the terrorist area. And I think you can certainly say that they have stopped some things. And I think ASIO deserves credit, which I didn't give them in the book, for this in one sense, is that when Dennis Richardson was head of ASIO, there was an immense amount of pressure to say that everyone who's a Muslim in Australia is a threat. And he strongly said, no, no, no. It is just the people who are going to commit violence that is the problem. And ASIO, and don't forget there are a lot of academics going with that line about Islam as an inherently violent religion and so on. So I think that's to Dennis Richardson's credit, but also to the people in subsequent heads of ASIO who stayed with that line.
On secrecy, do you feel like you're sort of losing the battle?
Well, I think the nation's losing the battle. The important thing about secrecy is a lot of misunderstanding about the damage that could be done by breaking secrecy. In Australia, there has never been a leak of intelligence secrecies that harmed anyone, whereas keeping intelligence secrets secret harms huge numbers of people. Take the weapons of mass destruction intelligence. If someone had leaked that before the invasion, there was a very good chance the invasion wouldn't have happened and all the turmoil that came with it in the Middle East would not have happened. Behind a wall of secrecy, bad decisions are often made because they're not contestable. No one's looking over the shoulder and saying, what's that?
Soon after you left the National Times job, you set up your own publication.
Yeah, a little publication called The Eye, which did manage to attract a few stories, a few leaks and that. One that I found sort of amusing almost, except it was deadly serious in one level, but the Hawke government raced into court when I published what I call the Hayden Papers, but there were a lot of papers coming out of Hayden's area. And this one showed that the US Secretary of State at the time, George Shultz, not only dictated a new policy to the government on nuclear ship visits, but also dictated the press release to the hapless...
Australian government.
Yes, the hapless Hayden at the other end of the phone sort of thing. And that was just a disgrace, and that's why they were very, very embarrassed about it.
How many times have you been injuncted?
I don't know. Quite a few, yeah.
More than 10?
I would think getting around that figure, yeah.
And the effect of the injunctions are like stop writs, right?
Yes.
They basically stop you from publishing.
Exactly. But also they can be very expensive to challenge against, and if they're wrong from the start, the idea should be that you have a chance, which is being put forward at the moment, to say so.
I think you've written that Australia can't really fight a war without the access to American weapon systems.
Well it's to the maintenance of those systems, because they won't share with us things like source codes and that for the computer stuff. But anything that goes wrong, which it often does on these things, has to be taken back to America and then the repair or whatever's done in secret. We are not allowed to have access to that. So we can't operate things like the plane, the F-35 plane you were talking about, but there's huge numbers of electronic systems. I mean, electronic systems are everywhere in weapons these days, and most of our weapons come from the United States. We can't build our own electronics industry to the scale needed, but we could make an issue of saying we want access to the source code for these things and build more of the electronic stuff here. And in the case of the F-35, we're always on about security in that. That plane operates with a computer feed from not even from the Pentagon, but from the manufacturer of the plane up to the plane. The poor pilot, imagine what would happen if something breaks. About the only advice he can get is, well, have you tried turning it off and turning it back on or whatever? and then down, again to the plane and back from the plane and all that. And that's leaving those signals wide open to interception, depending on where you're operating the plane from. And it's not very secure, and we need to think about that and whether... I mean, I think there's a very strong argument that we are wasting staggering amounts of money on mega projects for defence that are no longer recognising the world is changing. There's a world in which remotely operated planes and drones and all that sort of stuff is happening on every level.
Julian Assange has been criticised on many levels for not redacting the names of some of the people on the ground, some of the informers to the Americans. Do you think that's fair criticism?
It's certainly not fair. By the way, those things were only marked secret, which is not terribly high, but the moral responsibility for protecting the names of anyone who is really a source, a serious source, is up to the Pentagon. There's no doubt that WikiLeaks did the world a service there. And it's a bit... Look, obviously, Assange has got a difficult personality and so forth, But there's no gainsaying that the idea that he's not a journalist is just weird. He has published material, and that's, you know, in a sort of editor, in a role as a publisher. WikiLeaks does not go and get the stories. They're dependent upon people using Dropboxes or whatever to deliver them to them. And I mean, the Australian government should be doing much more. He's an Australian citizen, much more to protect his rights and to stop him being sent to the United States, where, you know, he will be put in jail for a very, very long time, unless he can get a defence under the First Amendment of the Constitution.
Hi, it's Bill Birnbauer, back with you. If you enjoyed that podcast and want to hear more interviews with top investigative journalists, go to democracieswatchdogs.org and locate the podcasts tab. On the site, you can watch video interviews with all the journalists featured in these podcasts. You can subscribe to our podcast and also to our newsletter for alerts about forthcoming interviews and our latest news. And please help us produce more interviews by supporting our work. As a registered non-profit organisation, we depend entirely on your support. Just go to democracieswatchdogs.org, press the donate button, and give us whatever you can afford. Every bit helps. It all goes into production and is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.